beautiful. And what I really want to know is, what is good in your life today? I'm Kia, and this is another episode of the Female Veterans Podcast. Today, I have with me Angie. She is just such an amazing person. She does so many things for the veteran community that it just blows my mind. She actually was the founder of the Veterans of Minnesota. She founded that and worked in Minnesota for many years, devoted to all sorts of veterans' issues. Thank you for being a guest today, Angie.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess I want to start by asking you what I ask everybody. What made you join the military?
Well, my best friend, Amy, joined the Army Reserves. So I wanted to follow her in her footsteps. Right. And you know, I was trying to figure out like what to do with my life, and I wanted to travel and go to college eventually and serve my country. It just felt like a good thing to do.
Right. I definitely understand that. So what branch did you go into?
Well, I went into the Army Reserves. I actually wanted to do what she was doing. I wanted to be a medic, but my ASVAB scores were more like electrical, mechanical. So they offered me a list of jobs, and I asked the recruiter, well, which one's the most challenging? And he said the aircraft armament missile defense system repair for helicopters. So,
oh my gosh, you worked on helicopters?
Yeah, this is in the 90s too. Not a lot of women were doing it.
I can imagine. That is so, so cool. What was that like for you?
Well, I was in the reserves first, and I was working on Cobras, and I thought it was pretty, you know, hardcore, gung-ho.
Did you feel like a badass? I would have felt like a badass working.
I was wondering if I could say that.
Yeah, I totally did. Listen, this is a veterans podcast, and okay. I know that a lot of us are Christians, and we are respectful, and we keep it clean, but there are also those of us who are, you know, I was a sailor. Every now and again, I'm known to have a sailor's mouth. So on the episodes where we get a little bit more raw, I will mark them explicit. On the cleaner ones, they'll be marked clean and people can pick and choose. This is inclusive. So say what you feel.
All right.
Okay. So I'm so excited to hear all about your being a mechanic for helicopters. I love helicopters. I, as a child, dreamed of flying helicopters, but I am blind as a bat. So that was probably never going to happen. I don't know. But I just love helicopters. So anyway, let's back it up. And okay, so you went into the Army Reserves. What was your rank?
Well, I went into the delayed entry program in 11th grade, just like my friend. So after 12th grade is when we went to basic and AIT. And I don't know, it was pretty neat at first. I mean, it was kind of boring. I mean, you only did like, you know, a little bit of time in the reserves. So within a year, I was like, I want to go active duty Army.
What was your rank when you went active duty?
E3.
Okay. And then you had already done boot camp. Right?
Right.
Okay, so what was boot camp like for you?
Well, it was all women at the time. They didn't have any integration. It was pretty fun. I actually liked it a lot. You know, I liked being challenged mentally, physically. And we actually lost a drill sergeant. So West Point cadets came and trained us.
Whoa.
Yeah, and they were pretty good looking, so it was nice.
And they were nice. as like what you? How old were you?
Oh God, I was a baby, so I was 18 by then.
Yeah, okay, so I can imagine how exciting it was for the West Point cadets to come through, and they were.
Oh, I know.
They all had good looking.
Yeah, they had to. You know, I actually dated one of them later on.
Did you? Oh my goodness! So, all right. So boot camp was fun.
Yeah, it was.
And some aspects, yeah. And I think sometimes, like, I had some really fun parts of boot camp too, so I can identify with that. But we were actually one of the first integrated companies in the Navy when I went in. And so we had like kind of a brother company, but it wasn't a brother company because it was part of our company. So they were like downstairs from us, but we got to spend a lot of time with the guys, which was pretty interesting. I didn't have any like crushes or anything that I can remember, but it was cool to just be around dudes. I always had a lot of guy friends. So I thought that was pretty fun in boot camp, surprisingly, because I didn't expect that at all. I expected it to be like all women.
Uh-huh.
So, okay. So after boot camp is done, you go, you were a reservist for a while, but then you went active. Okay. So what was it like going from a reservist to becoming active duty?
Well, the thing was, is I, wanted to be a pilot because I worked around them and I got to fly in the Cobra and fly the Cobra helicopter.
Wow, girl, that is so cool.
It was so awesome. Oh my God. So I was like, yeah, I want to go in because I was told that it'd be a better chance of becoming a pilot. So I went active duty and then I ended up working on a Cairo Warrior. It was a smaller bird, but it had four weapon systems. And I actually did, like do all the stuff I needed to do to get my package together to mm-hmm. become a pilot. But eventually I was like, no, I just want to get out.
Things changed.
It was okay at first, you know, it was like a 9-to-5 job. You go to the field for a while, you know, pretty whatever, boring.
Right on. Okay. So, all right. So I'm thinking of how you were like, you were all gung-ho to be a pilot and then things changed. So now that leads me to my next question is, what was your military experience like?
So AIT was really tough. I was there for 6 months. The drill sergeants were really hardcore. And then when I went active duty, I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was all right, but my platoon sergeant, you know, would say he'd love to throw me on the ground and fuck me. And
oh,
you know, I had coworkers say that they'd shoot me and the other girl if we ever went to war because we were women and couldn't handle and carry our weight.
That's just rude.
I was always trying to like carry, you know, do 250% more than the men just mm-hmm. to be noticed. And we were still treated like crap.
That sucks.
And then I had a coworker, he ended up, like becoming obsessed with me. We were really good friends for a couple of years. And one of his friends accidentally shot him in the face. And I think it did something to his brain.
Oh my God. What? Wait, what?
Yeah. They were playing around with guns and one of his friends shot him in the face.
Oh my God. And he stayed on active duty?
Yeah. I mean, he was in the hospital for a while, but.
Okay. Wow. Okay. It must have been like, not that bad.
No, it was just like in the cheek.
Okay. Just,
it was terrible, of course.
Yeah, because I'm thinking this has to be so terrible. And then he just was like, all right, well, I recovered. I'm going back to work.
Yeah, I mean, I was there holding his hand, you know, writing notes because he couldn't talk for the longest time. You know.
Oh my gosh. Oh, you were good friends. So you, like, when he went through that, you were like right supporting him.
Yeah, and that's when I think he fell in love with me.
I could see why that could happen. You know, it's always like you hear the stories of the nurse, and then they fall in love with the nurse, the wounded warrior. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
he became obsessed, and he would stalk me and call me all hours of the night, and he wouldn't leave me alone. He said if he couldn't have me, he's going to kill me.
Whoa.
So, yeah. Whoa.
Well, how did it progress to that? So it just started like him being grateful for you taking care of him. And then suddenly out of like normal friendship, it started to progress like more, like calling a little more.
It was right after he got back to work. I mean, he was changed. He was really not a nice person. So I don't know what happened, but he was eager to do something to me and I was really scared. So the commander moved me into his office and away from the guy. And they weren't going to do anything to him until he started getting caught driving with loaded guns and drunk a couple of times.
Okay.
And then they're like, oh, we'll kick you out.
Okay. Okay. I got to process this. Okay. So you had a stalker, so that's apparent, but I wonder how many women have had stalkers that were coworkers while they were in the military. I've never heard of that before. I'm sure you can't be the only one. So
But it's crazy to me. So he was your coworker, like when you worked on helicopters?
Yeah.
And you guys were buddies. He got shot in the face. And then you started being there for him. And then after that, he just started ramping up on his attention. Was there a point where you were like, hey, bro, not feeling this. I'm not feeling you like that. And then he just really lost it. Or did it, yeah. Was it just you, you noticed the change in him and you were like, I'm not going to hang out with you as much anymore because
no, you're different. No, he was following me and I actually lived off base and he was coming to my house and he was calling me all the time. And
so his attention ramped up.
Yeah, it just kept getting worse and worse.
You're like, you're calling me a little too much, dude. Like, we're friends, chill. And he's like, you know what? No, I'm going to keep doing it. And then he kept doing it and then started threatening you. Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah. Oh my God.
Fast? How long? What, like, what was the time frame? Was it like over a month or 2 month time?
Oh, it was a few weeks.
A few weeks? Okay. Yeah. So immediately you were like, wait a minute. You just gone from very little to too much attention, stop. And then he's like, I'm, you know, going to keep following you. And then you had to tell your command about it. And they actually were worried enough to move you away from him during work.
Yeah, but we still saw each other. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, mm-hmm. And then it took forever to get him out because they're only going to give him a general discharge.
Oh.
After getting caught with DWIs and loaded guns and he's going to kill me.
And threatening to kill you.
That part. They didn't care about him stalking me and all that. All they cared about was, oh, you got two DWIs and, oh, now we'll take you out. And he should have got dishonorable, you know?
That is true. So, I mean, well, I definitely would think as a woman that if someone was stalking me while I was in service, that they would give them a discharge, like if they're with loaded guns and there's being threats against my life, you would think that they would automatically want to get the person out. Like just, even if it was just like administrative, just like get them out of there. Like this guy is a danger to someone, but that but what you're saying is they didn't even, that wasn't even part of the reason why he got discharged. He was just discharged because he got was drunk driving with guns in his car and he got caught.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a couple of months, you know, before the battalion commander heard about this and he's called me into his office and he's like, this guy is seriously going to hurt you and we want to move you ASAP. Where do you want to go? I don't care where it is. I'll send you. Like in a week.
Oh my gosh.
So nobody else cared.
This was before he got out. So they were like, dude, you're not safe. You're not safe. We're going to transfer you. We're going to send you to another base.
Yep.
Were they like, you get to pick wherever you want to go?
Yep. That's it.
That's pretty decent. I mean, all things considered, I mean, obviously the right thing to do, I think, would have been launch an investigation and get him out as quickly as possible.
That wasn't
But obviously there was no investigation done, but at least you had someone, because a lot of these girls that I talked to didn't even have that, like didn't have someone say, hey, I believe you're in danger. Someone of authority other than like, you know, someone their same rank say, hey, I believe you're in danger. This is what I'm going to do for you, which is actually you would think was a lucky thing. So what happened after that?
It took a few months of torture. So after that, I said, well, I'm getting out because the Army isn't for me. I did my time. I'm good. You know, even the pilots didn't care for it. So everyone was negative all the time. So I was just like, screw it. And so I was like, well, my helicopter isn't anywhere but Korea and I wanted to travel. So I was like, this is my chance. So that's what I did. I picked Korea.
Oh, so at your duty station, morale was really low. Everybody just wanted to get out.
Yeah. Everyone's pretty. Yeah. They hated it.
Oh my gosh.
So I hated it. Yeah.
Well, if it's the culture, it's not, you know what I mean? It's really hard to be the one person that loves it and is super gung ho. If everybody's like, we don't like this. We're not feeling it. I'm out. I'm doing my time. I'm getting out of here or whatever.
Yeah. But, so why would I want to become one if, you know, they didn't like their job?
Mm-hmm, exactly. So you want it to be where you could work on your helicopter that you were, you know, your favorite one. And that was Korea?
The helicopter was not my favorite. I actually wanted to work on the Apache. But
Oh, okay. Very
cool. I want to go to Germany, Hawaii, or Colorado, but that didn't happen until after I got out, that my helicopter went there. So the only place I could go was Korea, and that's what I did.
Okay. So what was Korea like?
Well, I heard that they were starting to send women to this little base called Camp Stanton. It was like, 5 miles from the DMZ, mm-hmm. or militarized zone. And I was trying not to go there. So I was contacting someone of rank over in Camp Humphreys, which was by Seoul, which was Korea's capital. Mm-hmm. And it was more like a duty station, like Fort Bragg, where you just go to work, go home, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen. So I ended up going to Camp Stanton, and I was the third woman ever on that base since the Korean War.
Oh my God. What was that like?
Well, I was an E4 and I was the highest ranking. That'll tell you something.
And a fresh woman who outranks everyone.
Yeah. And back then I was good looking.
You're still good looking.
I'm 44 and I don't care. But, back then it was kind of like, well, guys were either like, panting, or they're like, oh, I've never worked with a woman before. What's this?
Two extremes. Yeah.
Yeah. So they, totally ignored you, treated you like shit, or mm-hmm. they're like, I want to get in your pants. Mm-hmm. And it was only 150 people, and you couldn't walk off the base because you could die. Those South Koreans in that local community had some bad experiences with us, so we couldn't go anywhere. The nearest place we could go was Camp Casey, which was an hour away by bus.
It sounds like kind of like being trapped.
We were. It was like being in prison. I mean, we just had this little area to be, and all you did when you got off, was like drink or work out or whatever, stay in your room.
It doesn't seem like much of a life.
No, and we were always training for war. We were in the field so much. I mean, the weather over there was so extreme. It was so cold in the winter. We had these bear suits you had to wear.
Oh my gosh.
It didn't matter how many layers I had on. I was freezing to death. So, and then the summers was so hot that you could cut out the air with a knife.
Oh my God. What, like humid, like super humid?
Yeah.
I just feel like it sounds like Miami, but times 10.
Oh, yeah. I'm from Minnesota, so we have extreme summer and winter there. Mm-hmm. But that was 10 times worse. And it's a peninsula, you got the ocean all around it. So,
Goodness. Yeah. So you're on this base that you didn't really want to go to. You have like no social life really other than working out and drinking because you're kind of like trapped on this base and you're one of three women or you're the only woman at this point?
Well, there was two and then me and then another one came over and who was my roommate, but we didn't really like each other. You know how women can be. Mm-hmm. We didn't bond and hang out. So it was just like you find some friends and that's it. It was really stinky. Like they use human and cow manure for all the rice paddies and they burn all their garbage year round. I mean, the whole country was just rotten smell and I just hated it. I absolutely could not believe I was there. And then my commander, he was such an asshole. He didn't really let us like get away with anything. He was so strict about everything. So mm-hmm. be crossing your T's and dotting your I's all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the command at Great Lakes where I served my entire enlistment is a training base, and it became the only training base. So it was super strict, like as far as other bases go, and nobody wanted to go there, which is why I was there the entire time because I got that base, and then I loved Chicago. Learning Chicago was amazing. I always call Chicago like my hometown, even though I'm from Philadelphia and I love it there too. But I spent so much, like all my young years, my 20s in Chicago because that's where I got stationed. And the only time you could really have any fun was off the base. I totally get, you couldn't get off the base to have fun in Korea, but I get living it under a strict command. It's just not fun.
Yeah,
if you can't get off the base, there's no fun to be had.
No. And I heard that the commander before him was lenient, so people could party, officers. Because there was only one bar. There was only one chow hall. Everybody had to share. Mm-hmm. They didn't have an officer's club, an enlisted club. So,
Right. All right. Well, that doesn't sound like a fun duty station at all. So, and then
worse.
And it only got worse. Okay. Please continue.
All right. So, there was an officer, married officer. He was hitting on me and I went and told on him, and, the equal opportunity officer, or what is it called? The EEO. See, like, I don't know. But anyway, there's an officer I told, and the other guy was standing right there, and he admitted he did that, and he didn't get in trouble.
What? So you went to, I guess, the correct personnel to file a complaint and told them that this officer is hitting on me. And he was like, yeah. And they're like, okay. And then you're like, what just happened? Like, I just reported a problem and everyone's just like, whatever.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. The EO officer said, put a letter in your file that you did this. And I'm sure it never got back to the States when the other officer left. So
of course not.
Disregard it like it was nothing. You know, like I said, men either want to get in your pants or they acted like they hated you. And, one time a sergeant in E6 busted into my room and violently raped me.
Oh my God.
And knocked me unconscious. And on the same level, there was a, you know, like a person's, you know, QC standing, you know, that watches, and they didn't do anything to see who coming out. They didn't do nothing. Now I was right a few doors down, and it was horrible. And I remember waking up the next day and my vagina hurt so bad I couldn't walk, and I went and told my friend.
Oh my God.
Then I told an officer, and then I told another friend, and I ended up reporting it. And gee, I wonder what happened there. Nothing.
Oh,
and instead of, and then this dude's wife comes from the States the next week, and everybody acts like nothing. And here I am, totally devastated. I felt so betrayed by my country, by my command. Everything was swept under the rug. And that's when I started drinking really heavily and tried to take a bunch of pills. And oh my God, I was just going crazy. I don't even know what to say.
Oh my God, girl. I am so sorry that happened to you. It sounds like a nightmare. Was this the same guy that you reported or a different guy?
Another guy.
Oh my God. So.
And I wanted to get off the base and they wouldn't let me. The only way you can get off the base is to get pregnant.
Oh my God. So, oh my God. I just can't. So you are on the base, you're in your barracks room, which is just a few doors down from we had, like, in the Navy, we had an office and there was someone in charge there at all times, kind of keeping us girls safe. And you were just a few doors down from this. This person is on duty. And yet, and you said an officer burst into your room and a sergeant. Burst in and violently assaulted you just a few doors down with someone that was supposed to be watching guard.
Right.
On duty. And nothing was done. You reported it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened when you reported it? Did they just say, what did they tell you?
You know, I don't even remember because I blocked a lot of that out.
I can imagine.
I started downhill spiraling. I remember nothing happened and maybe a talking to, but, that's what
you think. Maybe he got a talking to, like, maybe
talking to,
I feel like nauseous right now.
Yeah. And they made me, I went to mental health in Camp Casey, the place that was an hour away, cause we didn't have anything. And, I remember telling them all this stuff, and they even wrote to my commander trying to get me away from that base because, you know, things were happening and he wouldn't let me. He was a total asshole. And not only that, but then the commander was trying to find ways to kick me out.
Oh, okay. So this is the common, this is a common occurrence. It's starting to sound like to me. So a girl gets violently assaulted, and when she reports it, now it's how can we get her out of the military?
Yeah, because they want to keep it hush hush. So they're finding ways. They gave me Article 15s. You know, they're trying to find ways to get me out. And, you know, here I am all this time doing everything I'm told to do because that's the way it is. Yet these people can do whatever they want and not get punished. I mean, this is absolutely the worst betrayal I've ever experienced. And then at that point, I almost wanted to get kicked out, but I knew I'd lose all my benefits.
Yeah.
I was so crazy, miserable. Oh, boy.
I can just... So you said you went on a downhill spiral.
I started drinking a lot.
Mm-hmm. Were you drinking, like, before work, after work, like, that kind of drinking, or...
No, you can't do that. But as soon as I got done with work. I mean, we're all right there. People would know. I mean, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So... I got out, of course. I actually got out of there a month early so I could use 2 months of vacation before mm-hmm. I actually ETS'd.
Right, right.
So I went home as fast as I could, man, and I totally, like, tried to forget everything. I, like, mm-hmm. demilitarized myself. I didn't know about the VA, I didn't know about anything. I just wanted to get the hell out of there, get home, start working, going to college, doing what I wanted mm-hmm. to do. But, you know, I tried to tell people at first and no one wanted to hear it because it was too gross and ugly, you know? So I felt like, well, if nobody wants to hear it, then I guess I'll just forget about it.
You know, I'm still reeling because my mind is going, first, this girl had a stalker.
Yeah.
Who was a friend. So that is a betrayal, right? Uh-huh. Like you have a friend that you're cool with. You're like nursing him through a recovery. And then all of a sudden, whatever mental illness occurred due to that injury, he just sort of becomes angry and violent towards you because you won't return his affections.
Yeah.
And you have to leave. Okay, right. You have to leave in order to be safe. And then you get to another horrible command that you didn't actually want to go to. You tried to go somewhere else. Uh-huh. It didn't work out. So now you're on this like hellish base and you're one of four women, eventually four, and you're there in this kind of hostile environment because it's either a choice between, you know, disdain and harassment. Right, like every day of your life, people trying to get in your pants, or people disgusted that you're even present just by virtue of the fact that you're a woman. You know, you have a vagina, so you know, so you're sort of like either you're a target either way. You're like a walking target, and then it escalates to the point where an officer hits on you and nothing is done. So you already see, okay, they're not handling things efficiently here, you know, and then you get assaulted in an incredibly violent way, You're hurt inside and out and you still bravely report it and nothing is done.
No.
Not one thing, maybe a talking to if that you can sort of recollect because it was so horrible that your mind protected you by blocking stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So
and I forgot to mention, I actually walked into my room one time and my female roommate was getting gang raped by a bunch of guys. And
holy shit. I'm sorry. I apologize.
I know.
But that gets holy shit. Oh my God. Did that just come back to you?
Yeah.
Oh my God. What did you do? Do you remember?
I yelled at them. And then they ended up running out of there.
Oh my God.
I whipped open the door and I started yelling.
Oh my God. I just can't even imagine. And they scattered. What fuckers. I'm sorry.
By then, we didn't tell anyone because nobody cared.
Oh my God. I can't, like, just makes my stomach sick to even think that people could have such little empathy. like just not care.
They didn't want us there. None of the men wanted. They couldn't do a joke. They couldn't be themselves. You know, they had to act a certain way around us. They hated us. And then, yeah, if we told on somebody, we were, you know.
Of course. Because, right. Because then you're a snitch.
Right. So.
Yeah, I get it.
I didn't know such a thing existed until much later when I found out a lot of other women had the same things happen to them. So
I'm pretty sure, like, in these discussions that I have with women, I've heard several occurrences of situations where there were few women on the base where this transition was happening within our military and they had situations. And I've heard other stories where it wasn't that bad. You know, like the guys were, some guys were annoyed, but you always hear some guys didn't want us there. That's, yeah. That's the common thread. Okay, you don't always hear, about the harassment. Cause sometimes the guys are so, if a girl is lucky, she goes to a command where the guys just don't want her there because they're annoyed because they had to drill so much on sexual harassment. You know, they just don't want the chicks there. It's a hassle. They can't, like, whatever, do their guy stuff because now there's girls there. That's the lucky girls. And that's still, like, not a really comfortable situation.
No, it's
right,
not.
Right? So the unlucky girls end up in situations like you were in. Because then you've got harassment and you've got hatred coming at you. It's a hostile work environment and you have to do your job. Because you belong to the government. Yeah. Yeah.
So I hated the government. I hated the
I government. Bet you did,
like,
girl.
No one will ever tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. And after that, if I didn't like a boss or a job or anything like that, mm-hmm. it happened, like a boss was sitting on me, expecting me to do something to move up. Nope, I was done. See ya. Nope.
You developed like an issue with authority.
Yes, very much mm-hmm. so.
Because you couldn't trust your superiors. It makes perfect sense.
I mean, I got to do cool stuff. I got to fly multiple different types of helicopters. I even shot a 50 caliber machine gun out of one.
Whoa.
You know, I was the second woman in Korea to drive a tank, and I actually was doing it so rough that I threw a track off.
Oh my God. How cool was that?
I mean, there was cool things like that, you know, but I'm sorry. The other stuff that happened, it just, you know.
Because it just, it just ruined the entire experience, I can imagine.
Yeah, right. And I've always hated the military ever since. I mean, I'm proud I did what I did, but what it's done to me, the ripple effects throughout my life, I could have done without.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely understand where you're coming from. I mean, I didn't by any means have the worst experience serving. Okay. And I'll often say I had an amazing time in the military. I had actually too much fun. And then it was amazing until the day it wasn't. You know, and then from there, and from there, well, but then I became anti-establishment. And then I came out and I demilitarized myself, and I had other issues that I had to work through during my transition back to civilian life. Like, I did not like corporate America. I couldn't stand how people acted. And I had problems with authority as well. And I didn't trust, like, older men, you know, that with power, you know. And any sort of moral conflict. If I left so many companies because of a moral conflict, I can't stay at a company if you're shredding documents and I know about it. That mm-hmm. feels, and you're getting an audit. I'm not being a part of that. I gotta go. And so, I mean, I'm sure people would understand that, but for me, it was very triggering.
Uh-huh.
So on a very much lesser scale, I understand exactly what you mean, you know.
Like, everyone's story, you know, is not the same. Mm-hmm. And some are worse than others, but it's still, you know, who we are. And mm-hmm. there are common threads throughout.
Mm-hmm. And that's the point of this podcast. It is, we all have a story. Sometimes we have an amazing experience. Sometimes we have an awful experience. Sometimes it's good and bad, but we just get through it and we're like, whatever. But every one of us who served since the dawn of time of women serving has a story, and they are all important and they should be heard by all of us who are veterans, so that we can feel that community and that common bond. And for young women who might want to be going into the military, to see what what happened before them, and so that they can make an educated decision before they make that choice. So I think that's why it's important. And I got to tell you, I can't thank you enough for coming on and being so candid about your story and the just absolute abominable things that happened to you both in the States and Korea. Like I was reeling from the stalker. Like I couldn't even believe that. And I'm just so curious how many other women have had stalkers. If you're listening and you know someone and you yourself or a friend was stalked while serving, please contact me. I want to know about your story. So anyways, what happened next with you?
Well, I just want to end it with, you know, I had been molested by family members as a child and other people.
Oh, honey.
And I had a pretty bad childhood. So I was basically kind of running away from Minnesota and running away from everything. And then I ended up getting all this in the military. So when I got out, you know, I was a mess. And alcoholism followed me. I mean, I wasn't an alcoholic yet, but, you know, doing it. And, you know, I went to school and I went to work and I was back with my friends and meeting new friends and having a good time. But I was always the last one up at a party. Mm-hmm. You know, I would get sloppy, drunk, you know, mm-hmm. I could drink more than other people. And
yeah, well, the military will do that to you.
That's true. Mm-hmm. But I kind of took it to the next level and people were kind of like, what's up with her? Mm-hmm. But then I had a friend get me hooked on meth and doing that for about a year. Yeah. Well, the thing was, is like when I got home, like even though I was trying to suppress everything and I was trying to like ignore it, it came out like sideways. So I was constantly triggered, you know, by, you know, my childhood or the military. And yeah, I couldn't cope. I didn't have any coping mechanisms. All I knew to do was run. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't all the time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I became a meth head and then I tried to actually kill myself at age 25.
Oh my God. This is heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, I totally get the urge to self-medicate and just forget everything that happened to you. You know, but of course, meth is, you know, we all know that it's a horrible drug and everything like that. And it's just heartbreaking to know that that's the only place you could find comfort for that time period.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, I got really depressed. And then I started doing the relocation thing to, you know, running to see mm-hmm. if that would help. And it always did at first, but then I'd find myself, I mean, the alcoholism got me into fights and, you know, lost relationships. And then it started getting me into legal trouble. I got DUIs. I got assaults on America. I got a lot of stuff from age 28 to 32 or something like that. 34. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I became a real bad girl. On one hand, I got a degree and I had my own house and I had a great car and I had a great job. And on the other hand, here I am ruining it because I wasn't dealing with my shit mm-hmm. and I was getting in trouble.
Yeah.
So I ended up, you know, started losing big time. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in Florida and I had a good job, you know, all this stuff. And the alcoholism, and I got DUIs here. And I started sliding back down, and I ended up homeless, jobless, and broke, and a crackhead.
Wow, girl.
In my 30s.
So
yeah, not very proud.
No, but you're speaking your truth. And the truth of the matter is that this spiral happened because of what you endured, you know? Yeah. And if these things are never worked through and never dealt with, then this is what happens. You see it all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a struggle. It's a real struggle to, you know, reacclimate to civilian life when you're carrying traumas with you like this. You witnessed mm-hmm. a gang rape, for God's sake, and actually was the hero of that story. And broke that up, you know,
they're all broke, but yeah,
still, they had that in there. The liquor just brought it out, made it easier for them to cope with the fact that what they were going to do, but they wanted to do that before they got drunk. I'll tell you that. And so my point is, everything that you went through, even as a child, all of those traumas that you had to endure, right, all the way through your life, then you go to a place where you're like, now I'm going to be on my own and I'm going to do this really awesome job and I am going to make a life for myself and I am going to have a good life because you know what? The United States government is going to give me one. I'm going to give up my civil liberty. I'm going to become property of the government in order to leave my past and build a bright future for myself, right? And right. Then you get there and all this shit happens to you and you come out broken. You know what I mean? And so for years, you're fighting and to just have to live life and just cope. Like every day is just trying to cope, you know? And right. So it's easy to understand this was the catalyst. That was all the catalyst because you lost the hope that you could have a new beginning and a bright future through the military. It was destroyed. It was shattered. Your vision was shattered. So you go through years trying to cope and deal with all these traumas that you're carrying with you, you know, regularly. It's easy to understand the struggle. The struggle is real.
Well, yeah. And I thought I was alone, you know,
mm-hmm.
I really did. And I didn't know about anything but the VFW and American Legion. And that was a good old boys club where old men talk about wars and drink. And I didn't want any part mm-hmm. of it, you know, and I didn't know that I could apply for VA benefits, even if it was zero. I just, you know, nobody told me. Mm-hmm. So I just like, and a lot of people didn't believe I was in the military. So I was like, whatever. But at one point I told someone in the VFW my story and he's like, I think you should file a claim with the VA for PTSD. And I was like, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, oh my God, that set me on a whole nother trajectory.
Mm-hmm. It happened to me that way.
Really?
To me that way. Yeah. Like there was a time in my life that I rarely tell this story, but I really struggled coming out of the military. And when I came out, I thought I was about to slay the corporate world. I thought I had, you know, the world on a string. You know what I mean? I was sitting on a rainbow. You know what I mean? I was just going to go smash life. And about three and a half years later, I was left penniless by my husband of 5 years, just about to be homeless. And I had like no food in my house. I was like Coinstar couch cushions trying to eat. Like, sure. And I was lucky because my friends came through. I wasn't alone. I had my girls and my girls came through and helped me out. One of my friends helped me get a job. And from there, because I'd been laid off just a couple months before, and she helped me. She was like, hey, they seem to like veterans at this job, but I had to drive an hour out of the city to go to work every day, which was fine. Because I was like, yeah, I mean, when you're at that low point and you're just like looking up, you're like, how am I going to get back up? But I have to get back up. I just don't know how. And my friend was like, I just got this job. You should come. They seem to like veterans here. And I went. Yeah. And I went and I interviewed and they hired me and because I knew my stuff, you know what I mean? But because I was sick, because I have fibromyalgia, and I have Epstein-Barr that reoccurs in CMV, I get sick and I get tired a lot. It's very hard for me to work a corporate type job, but I'm pretty badass. When I'm well, I'm pretty badass. Yeah. When I'm not well, I'm like not reliable in any way, shape, or form because I need to be in my bed, honestly. So, right. But I didn't know. I had applied for benefits before I got out and they denied me. And I was just like, oh, well, because this chief in my TAPS class was like, you have an illness. You doing this. He's like, you better apply for benefits before you get out, girl. And I was like, what? Oh, and he gave me some information. I actually learned more from him than I did in the TAPS class about going back into civilian life, about the transition. He was really great, actually.
At least you had that, or even in the military, because I didn't have that.
Well, that was on my way out the door. And so I went. That's when I found out that I had fibromyalgia and everything. I filed a claim, and they denied me. And I was like, okay, I got denied. I had no, like, no thought to be like, I should fight this, you know? And
yeah,
until,
you know, that happened to me. I got nothing. So yeah.
Same thing. And then I didn't know, like, hey, they will oftentimes deny you at first because, you know, they don't want to pay you. Like, I was still kind of really naive. I was in my 20s. I was still really naive about how the world works and, right. And how the government can be, even though I had experienced some things while I was serving that was like eye-opening as to how the real world was. Wow. And so make a long story short, years later, I started figuring this stuff out and I started helping other people figure theirs out. Like if I'd have met That's you, awesome. I would have been like, girl, you need to do this, and this, yeah. And I will help you. I'll help you fill out your paperwork. Back then it was like an old timey website that you had to go to, look like some one of the first Apple computer websites. I don't know, but it was, you know, and I would walk people through it and stuff because I'd be like, you know what? I'm hearing all these stories that, you know, a lot of times veterans, they won't go to mental health or anything, but then we'll talk to another veteran.
Right.
So it, you know, it was easy for me to just go, you know, I didn't think like you were part of, I don't know what, 30 organizations that help veterans.
Yeah, that was later.
right. But I didn't have the foresight to like go be a part of something like that. I just kind of did it in my living room, you know, or over the phone and just kind of help people out. Just, you know, I didn't think of it as anything other than, hey, this is a brother or sister, you know.
That's great though.
You know, and it just went like that for like the last 20 years until I started doing this. But that's what happened. I actually fought the government for 10 years and I kept fighting because once I realized, you know, they didn't, and fibromyalgia is tricky too, you know, because you can't see it like PTSD.
Can't test it.
So it's tricky. And then they don't want to approve you anyway.
Right.
They don't really care that, you know, you're losing money, that you can hardly take care of your kids because you're sick. Like they don't really care. Like if you have mono, if you've ever had mono, you know that it's like, it feels like you've gotten hit by a truck. Like you've been rolled over with a steamroller and you're so fatigued all the time that you can barely keep your eyes open. And it lasts for like 3 months and you have body pains and flu-like symptoms. But the worst part I think is it's like excruciating fatigue. It's so tired. You're so tired. It hurts. And
I remember in high school, some people had that.
Mm-hmm, and that's what it's like. And so you can't go to work like that. You know what I mean? And not in corporate. Like I worked in corporate and I was like working my way up the ladder, you know? And so it was just not going to be viable. So I ended up having to fight the government for a really long time. I feel you 100%. Like
there's a lot of people that it took 10 years. Me, it didn't take that long.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take for you?
Well, they only gave me like 30% for like MST, military sexual trauma and PTSD. And then I had to fight for 50%.
Oh my God. They gave you 30% for military. How do you even rate that
they
low?
Don't care. Nobody cares.
Oh,
so, God. You know, it wasn't until I ended up, I put myself in inpatient treatment in 2009 that the VA gave me 100%, but it was temporary.
Why was it temporary?
Because they thought I was going to get better because I was doing all these bad things because of the military. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, now she's getting help. We'll give her 100%. I don't even know why they did it. I didn't ask for it. And because I had nothing. I was nobody. I was a crackhead. I didn't care. Mm-hmm. But I did care. And I wanted to get better. And I knew there was more to life than what I had been doing for the last 10 years.
God, girl.
So I actually had to fight to keep my 100% now for, God, 10 years.
You've been fighting to keep it now.
I've had to fight at, you know, all those reviews. They always want to take it away. You don't want to get better at the VA because then they'll take it away or reduce it.
Oh man.
But on the other hand, you want to get better, but you're just like stuck in this thing. But actually, I mean, honestly, I have been getting worse as I age. Mentally, like I like get more things that are wrong with me, and it doesn't matter what they do. They just add more pills and more therapy. But I have all the things that are in PTSD, you know, depression, anxiety, mm-hmm. You know, I twitch a lot. It's hard for me to hold a job anymore. I mean, I haven't had a real job since 2013, like a corporate job. Mm-hmm. I started getting hallucinations and I Girl. Couldn't look like that anymore. I had to be somewhere every day, 9 to 5. I got fibromyalgia. I just got that, you know, this year, but I've had it for years. And I didn't know what it was.
Goodness, girl.
A lot of different things.
I don't wish that on anyone. I'm sorry to hear that you have it.
I do. And I knew there's something wrong with me. And I also gained a ton of weight, not only just from all the medications they put me on, but I wanted to get fat so I wouldn't be hit on anymore or raped or anything. You know, it was like a defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm. I did that.
Yeah.
I did that too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My 30s. Yeah, I won't get into it, but it's another story for another day, but I definitely identify with that.
Maybe with someone else, you can open up about that.
I'll tell you once we hang up off of here, I'm just not going to put it out there.
I actually want to know you more than this.
So. Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you. You know what? I love the opportunity to meet all of these incredible women. Everyone I have met and has been on the podcast so far, we're in touch. Like, I love all of you girls, by the way, shout out to all my guests. I love you guys. Okay. Yes. So we just kind of been really kicking it and I totally veered off of the interview. So we're going to bring it back in and you're talking about finally you got some help from the VA and you started applying for benefits. Okay. Let's start from there and you can continue with your story.
Well, I mean, I had to work for a few years really hard to stay off the alcohol, man, because I'd been really abusing it. And I was going to the VA for everything. I was going to AA. I was going to VA. I mean, anything they had a class for MST, anger management, PTSD, mindfulness, you know, I was art therapy. I was taking it all. I was going to therapy. I was trying different medications. I really had to work really hard to stay sober. And not only that, but I really had to peel the layers and it took a while and it was extremely excruciatingly painful. And I wouldn't wish that upon anyone. It was probably the hardest thing I ever had to do was actually find out who I was again, find out what I enjoy out of life without having a drink, find out, you know, what makes me tick, having to go back and tell, you know, my story and remembering everything and finding out what my issues were, you know. I mean, I had ignored it for so long. So I spent quite a few years from 2009 to about, I don't know, 2000, well, till today. I mean, I'm still working on myself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, CBT and all those things, DBT. I mean, there's so many things I've done at the VA and I love it. But, you know, the main thing is I learned that I'm always going to have mental health problems and just like I'm always going to have physical problems. But learning how to manage it and knowing that you can live with it and it might not ever go away is key. Mm-hmm. You know, I try, the doctors try. Some things get better over time. Mm-hmm. Some things get easier to cope with. And, you know, you get more tools in your toolbox and you can open it up and say, yeah, this will work for this, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and once I got sober, my life changed. I mean, it felt like I believe in God, you know. I think that having a higher power of any kind or whatever helps because you give it up to the universe or whatever and... Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I can't control my life anymore. I screwed it up. Please help me. And it just seemed like every time I turn around, good things started happening, you know?
That's great.
And, you know, I became a writer and artist. You know, I've always been an artist, but I got better at that. I was an actor. I was a martial arts instructor. I mean, I met my husband through Taekwondo and we got married in 2013.
Aww. You know,
had a house. I have great stepsons, you know, instant family, you know, pets, you know, everything's just turned around and it's been great. You know, like I can't believe I feel so free of a lot of the stuff. And, you know, you say I talk candid, but I do that because I've told my story so many times, you know, I don't bawl anymore. Yeah. You know, I used to get so shaky and have panic attacks, but, you know, I've done it so many times. I think it's very therapeutic to get it out publicly, privately, with a friend, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, so yeah, I was at the VA, and this organization called Veterans in the Arts was advertising. And what they did was they helped veterans with therapy through art therapy. And, you know, once I did that, I started meeting people. And then this one lady's like, oh, there's auditions for a play called Telling Minnesota through the Telling Project. They went around this different country, and they get like so many actors and train them how to act and be in a play and tell their story. And that was the first time I did it publicly. And that was 2013 as well. And after that, man, you just start getting connected with people and meeting more people, and then people want you to help them with this and that. And next thing I know, I'm volunteering for all these organizations, and then start getting awards, and then it would make other people go, I have a similar story. And then they'd reach out to me, and I would talk to them and help them the best I could. You know, it just, the whole world opened up. There's so much out there.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Talk.
So, okay. So you were saying that you were a part of all of these organizations, and I know I have a list of at least 20 right here. So can you name all the organizations that you were a part of so that we know what they are?
Well, there's more than this, I'm sure, but I was I was in Telling Minnesota, and they're in New York, also came to Minnesota through the Minnesota Humanity Center and taught a bunch of us how to do storytelling. So we did that and then read it to the public, again, our story. And I was a public relations officer for a nonprofit called Women Veterans Initiative for a few years. And I was an Alcoholic Anonymous sponsor speaker. And I volunteered for Minnesota Special Olympics, Animal Humane Society, Habitat for Humanity, Goodwill, Feed My Starving Children, ERA Minnesota, the Equal Rights Amendment. I was a squad leader. I was a volunteer at the Salvation Army. I mean, it just goes on. So I'll read a few more off. I was on the Veteran Voices Award Committee at the Minnesota Humanity Center. They have a Veteran Voices yearly award that goes out mm-hmm. to a certain number of vets that do outstanding things. And, I was like, and then I actually got an award, which was pretty cool.
That is cool.
I was also with the Veteran World Cafe Veteran Resilience Project. And again, a lot of stuff is in Minnesota, so some people might never have heard it. I was also the VFW State and National Recruiter. I founded Veterans of Minnesota. I was at the Ars Bellum Foundation doing media relations, which was an art therapy nonprofit in Minnesota. I was the Lean In Women Veterans Chair. I got to meet Sheryl Sandberg a couple times.
Wow.
Yeah, do some training over there in her neck of the woods. That was great. That was a nice national position. And I also did Circle Development and Lean In Minneapolis St. Paul. Oh, I actually founded the Lean In Minneapolis St. Paul Veterans. If you want to know more about Lean In, just Google it. It's women helping women.
We'll put a link in the description box.
There you go. And then, yeah, I managed so many Facebook pages for so many organizations too. And the last one was Service Women Who Serve. And you can go, you know, look that up on Facebook. But the biggest thing I ever did was a 6-month project in Minnesota called the I Am Not Invisible campaign. And actually it started in Oregon with the, you know, Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs, Elizabeth Esterbrooks. And so they came, like, Ars Bellum Foundation, the founder was Bridget Cronin. She actually passed away, but she heard about this and wanted to do it in Minnesota. But she didn't know anybody that would do it with her. The person she was going to do it with left her job. So I stepped up and said, I'll help you. We can get this done. Because I had this huge network. And this was 2017. Mm-hmm. So I knew a million people, you know. I'm like, yeah, we can do this. So I didn't realize how much work it would be. But for the next 6 months, man, we were pounding it. We were getting women interested in how it works. There's like these posters in black and white. And, you know, we have a photographer taking different poses and then, you know, picking one that resembles their personality. And then you write, you know, a little bit about them on the bottom. And that, so we got that done and it was a huge success. You know, we'd go to different sports events or arts events, or even at the Minnesota State Capitol, they were up. It was really cool. And actually, a lot of VAs, state VAs, have been taking this on. The last one who did it, I think, was Georgia.
Wow. And
cooperated with the, or coordinated and cooperated with the Women Veterans Social Justice nonprofit there. Mm-hmm. And I think they had the most women I've ever seen in one campaign. But it's the same layout, same rules, same everything. So yeah, if you look it up, you'll see it all over the place.
Definitely got to check that out. It sounds amazing.
Every state should have one.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. I just got back from Minnesota, actually, because a book was done about the Minnesota campaign. And wow. I was a big part of that, too. And yeah, it was just, we just had the launch on Wednesday. And it was awesome. It was so amazing. The book is great. So it's the I Am Not Invisible campaign, Minnesota. And it's on Amazon now. So,
well, we will definitely link that up in the description box below. That is incredible. I mean, look at that. I mean, look at you going from all of this trauma, like all the work to, first of all, you work every day to stay sober.
Yep.
And you work every day with these illnesses, and you work every day to just be through the trauma. Like, and just come out on the other side of it, you know? And while you're doing all this internal work and these internal struggles, look at everything you've put out into the world and done for your veteran brothers and sisters. It's just incredible.
And not only do I do it to help people, but I want other people to say, hey, I can work through my stuff and get there, do that same stuff too. Mm-hmm. You know, I want other people, encourage other people to help, because that's how, you know, we all get better if we help each other.
That's absolutely right. I mean, your story is just so unique and incredible. And I'm just amazed by it. Like, from high highs and low lows, like, you've been all over the place, but you're landing on your feet. You have a beautiful family. You know, and you've worked through so much, and you've done so much to contribute to other people getting better. I just admire you so much.
Well, I appreciate it, you know, but there's a lot of people out there like me, actually. You know, more and more people are doing the same stuff. And I actually relocated to Florida last year, and my life completely fell apart. It seems like every other week I get bad news. And I actually into bad behavior. Mm-hmm.
So the struggle is real. I can't say that enough. You know, you get, like I said, highs and lows. So you hit a roadblock. Yeah.
And no matter how great of a person you are or how hard you've worked at stuff, life still happens and you still can fall.
True story. So how are you doing right now?
I'm doing good.
Good.
I'm maintaining. I mean, I got to the point where I was looking at assisted suicide. That's how low I was getting.
Goodness, girl. Oh, don't ever do it. What did you do to stop yourself?
I reached out and talked to people.
Mm-hmm. Best advice ever.
You need professional help. And I go, yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy to fall back into old behaviors and old, you know, I have depression, I have all these things, you know. And when life really, really gets you, sometimes you relapse and stuff, but I always find a way to just get through it. I'm feeling my feelings, let it, no matter how bad they feel, they're going to get better. They're going to work themselves out. Life is always going to get better. Every day is new. You always have a chance to, you know, look at things differently. And that's how I've been reframing my mind, is like, I got to stop being in the muck and I got to be grateful for things. And I got to go into my toolbox again and got to reach out and talk to people. And man, there's a lot of people that'll help. You just got to ask.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is.
And I know you're going to ask me about, well, what's your message for everyone? But
you know, what's really funny is I was just about to say, well, my last question for you was going to be, you know, what advice did you have? And I was going to say, but you just said it. And We were on the same page. You're all good. You're all good. Okay. Well, I guess with that amazing advice, we're going to wrap this up. Is there anything else you want to say to everybody before I sign off?
Well, I don't want to stop.
Oh, honey. Well, what else you got? Come on.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, it really boils down to, you know, if you're struggling, you got a lot of things. If you haven't even made that first step and told anyone your story because it's too hard, you know, get some help, whether it's private or VA or whatever, or a friend or anyone you can trust, and get it out. Write it down even and burn it. I don't care. You got to get that stuff out of you. Mm-hmm. And then once you do that, you can go on the path to healing. You know, it's the really only way. And every time you get stuck, you know, and reach out and learn and do whatever you can, take any kind of classes or whatever. And not only just like therapy and stuff, but like, do something you enjoy, like get back into something you did as a kid or a young adult. Mm-hmm. You know, find things in life you enjoy, and eventually you'll start to be, you know, feel better and become who you're meant to be and find yourself again, because stuff's always going to happen and there's nothing you can do to change it, but you can move on.
Again, a more amazing advice from Angie. I appreciate it so much. That is just such good advice. And actually, I am working on a project right now. I am going to be offering free 15-minute phone consultations. I don't know if I would call it a consultation, really, because I want to encourage everyone to share their story. Maybe you don't want to come on the podcast and share your story that way. But if you want to talk to me, I got 15 minutes for you for free. You know what I mean? Call me up. I'll put, this is in process right now. So it's coming soon, and you'll be able to call me. We'll schedule a phone conversation and you can tell me your story for 15 minutes. And if you've never told it to anyone, I'll listen and I will keep your story for you. No one else will ever need to know it without your permission. And if you want to talk to me longer than that, then I will have to figure out, there will probably be a cost, but I'll have to figure that out. For right now, I just want you to be able to come on the show and share your story. And if you're not comfortable with that, have somebody to talk to, kind of like peer support, you know? So that's coming. And it's based on exactly what you said. Sharing your story, get it out. If you don't want to tell me, I highly recommend journaling. I also highly recommend write it down and burn it. Mm-hmm. Write it down and burn it, cut that cord, release it to the universe or to God or whoever you believe in, and just release it. Because as you start cutting cords with the trauma, the healing can begin. And what we're here about, what we're here for, what we're living for, what we're promoting here at the Female Veterans Podcast is a healing journey. Telling your story is on your path to healing. And we want all of us, our veteran sisters and brothers, to heal and to be whole and to thrive. So with that, I really am going to wrap it up, or else this is going to become two episodes. But before I do, I want to say thank you, Angie. Thank you so, 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 so much for coming on this show and being a part of my project, this podcast.
Thank you for it. This is great. I love it.
It's like a sad story, but you're so fun and amazing to talk to. So it's been really incredible to get to know you today.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much.
And with that, you guys, I'm going to wrap it up. So I'm going to say to you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for coming on this journey with me. I appreciate you so, so much. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time.